Good morning. This is Rachel Hannell with the Weekly Reader Radio Program, and I have a guest via phone today. I have on air with me Jacob Strunk. Hi, Jacob.
Ahoy.
Good. How are you?
Doing very well, thank you.
Well, good. Why don't you tell our listening audience where you are calling from?
I am right now in sunny Hollywood, California, where my cat Steven is perched in an open window.
That gives us a good vision of where you are.
Mental image.
That's perfect. And I have had far-flung guests on the show before. I mean, I like to stay in the Mankato area or maybe go into the state a little bit more. But every so often, I do have people people who I enjoy reading and will invite them to join me on air before. So it's not that unusual that I will have a guest from far away by phone. But I suppose I should let people know why I'm talking to you. And we actually have a mutual friend. That's correct, right?
That would be correct.
Yes, and our mutual friend is Anne Rosenquist-Fee. And the listeners of this program, I'm sure, are familiar with Anne. She's kind of one of those women who's out and about everywhere, buzzing about town, and she's been on my program as well. But why don't you tell my audience where you met Anne?
I met the ubiquitous Anne Rosenquist-Fee in Maine, actually. We are both MFA candidates at a program called Stone Coast, which is run by the University of Southern Maine. And so twice a year we trot out to Maine and look at the ocean and sit on glacial rocks and wear turtlenecks and talk about writing. And that is where I met Ms. B., Mrs. B.
Right. So we are from one coast to the other. I'm talking with you in L.A. and Hollywood, and Anne's here, but yet you met her out on the other coast in Maine. And I'm really intrigued by that whole program. It's a low residency MFA. So like you said, you're just going out there twice a year. Is that right?
Right. There are these kind of intensive residencies twice a year in which pretty much every waking moment for the 10 days that you're there is devoted to either writing or reading or talking about one of the two,
mm-hmm.
Either formally in workshops or informally over, you know, the local microbrew.
Sure. It sounded intensive. I was talking to her when she got back, and she said that's how it was from morning to night, and even after classes were done, everyone departs to a community spot to continue to talk about writing.
The watering hole.
Local watering hole.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm not surprised. I mean, I live here in Mankato, and, you know, not like you never would find a writer in a local watering hole. That's certainly not any type of fiction, that's for sure. And so Anne told me about a lot of the people in her program and said there's these people doing these great things here at Stone Coast, and I think that they would be great guests for your show. So here we are. Here we are by phone. Why don't you tell us the type of writing that you do?
What do I do? Well, I kind of divide my time between making films and writing prose.
Mm-hmm.
Prose being, I guess, the easier of the two because it doesn't require anything other than, you know, like a cat napping next to me and a pot of coffee.
Yeah.
And so, I've been focusing a lot on the prose as of late, especially since I've been in this MFA program. And I write kind of dark, quirky character things, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, I write weird stuff. Bugs and history and weird.
That sounds good. You know, you can never have too much of people thinking in a completely creative way. Have you been writing since you were real small and always writing in that type of style?
As long as I can remember.
Yeah.
When I was in, I think I was in second grade, and I wrote this, we were supposed to write like our Thanksgiving experience.
Mm-hmm.
This had to be second grade. And I wrote this, like, novella. I wrote this, like, 14-page novella about a killer turkey that rampages across the countryside and kills everyone and eats them in return because, you know, the Thanksgiving thing, the role reversal. And it won this weird, like, district youth writing award thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was probably the first moment that I realized that however bizarre what I'm doing is, it apparently has an audience and some merit.
That's great. So even at 8 years old or whatever, you're getting that that feedback, that positive feedback right then that all writers long for.
Well, I think as long as you are dedicated to what you're doing, the feedback will come. As long as you're producing, there will always be people there to consume.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a great way of putting it. And I think that we all would like to hear a sample of this writing. So I understand you have something that you can read for us. So I invite you to go ahead and tell us a little bit about it, and then go ahead and give us a sample of what you're doing.
Okay. Yeah, I do. I have to set it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. This is from the novel that I'm finishing up right now, which hopefully will be gracing Barnes and Noble across the country next year.
Yeah.
The novel is about a Civil War buff who's been institutionalized for 13 years in Texas and kind of without warning is released into the wilds of the Panhandle to find his being and find his own way and kind of rediscover how to assimilate into society and interact with people and all that. And along the way, he meets a number of interesting characters, one of whom will be in this section, and that is an old friend of his named Jennifer, who kind of hooks him up with a job through her husband, who's also in here. But Elliot, who's the main character, also, I don't want to give too much away in the way of plot, but he also befriends a bug, an insect, a cicada, named Joseph. And so those are the characters that kind of come into play here.
Okay.
So I will begin. With Joseph nestled soundly in his drawer in the nightstand, Elliot left the house at precisely 7:30 Saturday night. He went straight for his usual parking spot in an alley two houses down from his own. He had found that spot more convenient in the long run because he didn't have to worry about the street sweeping hours every other Monday from 8 to 10. Not to mention, he thought, his car was much less likely to be accosted again at the expense of more innocent panes of glass. Of course, in Vega, Texas, street sweeping consisted mostly of pushing the piles of leaves and occasional empty beer cans up over the curb and onto the sidewalk. The alley, however, was all but forgotten by everyone but the stray cats, and Elliot found dirty little paw prints running up and over his hood, windshield, roof, and down onto the trunk. He'd find little spots on the hood where the dirt was missing, the place where the cats would curl up and take advantage of his still warm engine. This evening, however, he casually turned into the alley to find it empty. Elliot stood staring into the vacant alley. A few bits of trash clung to the sides of the houses that made up the alley's walls. Cigarette butts and bottle caps lied strewn along the pavement. Elliot heard the distant mew of a cat, but his car was definitely gone. Gone. Well, they finally did it. They killed my car. He was speaking to himself, but more so he was speaking to everyone. He was speaking to the very air around him. Elliot was orating to the cats and the litter and the bugs hidden in the long grass to his sides. Elliot was speaking for the benefit of the darkening sky and the leafless trees that stood above him. They killed my car, he repeated, then hung his head and turned. Everything he had gone through, 13 years of piss-smelling existence in a tiny white box, countless acquaintances with incontinence and Tourette's, a near lifetime being behind stone walls and white paint, and this is what it comes down to. His things, his car, his possession, taken from him on the whim of some lowlife whose crime was disrespect. His feet scuffed the pavement as he turned onto the sidewalk that led to his house. And then something, the cry of a bird maybe, or perhaps just the wind, but something brought his face up and his eyes away from the sidewalk and he saw it, there, across the street, a few houses down. There was his car, intact and waiting for him. He stopped dead, then headed for it. He broke into a jog, aiming straight for the headlights, the worn grill. He paid no attention to his steps now, and as a result, he stepped over 2, 3, 4 forgotten pennies. He stepped on the remnants of a dead bird, his foot crushing it with a brittle snap. Elliot bounded across the street and down, padding along the concrete. Behind him, old chewing gum paper clips, a spent shell casing, a page torn out of a Playboy, all the worn swept past, and Elliot focused on just one thing, his Nova. It was here, it wasn't gone, or had it just been returned? Elliot jogged to the driver's side door, plunged in the key, and pulled it open. There, on the passenger's seat, was his note, the note he had left asking for a gracious surrender. Beneath it, in a clean, legible hand, was written this, in red ink, "Thanks for the ride." Elliot looked at the page, then crumpled it again and tossed it onto the floor of the car. He held the key in his hand, looked at the doorbell that served as the car's ignition, the button that would breathe life into an engine older than those who had probably driven it. Elliot sighed, relieved. The car was here. The car was... And then he noticed it. Elliot straightened, then pushed the car's door slowly shut. As the door clicked shut, the dome light blinked out, and Elliot crossed to the front of the Nova, staring directly at the windshield. He still held his keys. In his pocket was his wallet, and inside the wallet was the 20 he planned to spend on a gift for Davis and Jennifer. But he wasn't thinking of that now. Charcoal and meat and cheap wine was the last thing on his mind. Elliot stood and stared across the hood of the Nova at the windshield, at the spot on the glass where the crack should be, had been the day before. Elliot stood and stared at the spotless, unmarred glass, and he wondered. He wondered. Elliot's finger pushed the doorbell just a few minutes before 8 o'clock, and he stood beneath the dirty orange of the porch light and listened to footsteps approaching. Davis opened the door, a glass of dark amber in his hand. "Elliot!" "Hello," Elliot replied, lifting the bottle of wine he purchased on the way over. Davis inspected it. "Red or white?" Davis asked. "I'm just kidding, Elliot. Get in here." Davis held the door wide for him, and Elliot stepped through, wiping his feet on the mat. The house was warm and smelled like chicken soup with a hint of something else. Something else Elliot couldn't quite place. Davis clapped Elliot on the shoulder, then took the bottle of wine and held up his glass. "Thanks for having me," Elliot said. "Oh, enough. Can I get you a drink?" "Water, please." "Water it is." Davis padded off again. Elliot listened to the muted thud and wisp of Davis's sock-clad feet on the Berber carpeting. He wondered for a minute if he should pull his own shoes off, and then Jennifer entered and strode confidently to him. "Hi, Elliot," she said, pulling him into a strong hug. Elliot hugged back, feeling the warmth of her. Her hair smelled like lilac. She squeezed harder. Elliot patted her back. She rubbed his. She stepped back. "Hi." "So glad you're here. So glad." Jennifer touched his shoulder and looked into his eyes. Elliot looked down at the floor. "Should I take my shoes off?" No, that's fine," she said. She rubbed his arm, and then Davis was back. He handed Elliot a glass with a clink of ice cubes. Elliot looked down at it, then recoiled at the smell, the tang of the thing. Davis laughed. "Water, with just a hint of scotch," he said, and then raised his glass. After a moment of watering eyes and fuming sinuses, Elliot raised his own, and the two glasses clinked together in the air, birds in flight colliding in a thunderhead. Jennifer watched, smiling. Elliot watched her, too, out of the corner of his eye. More than watching, he thought, she was looking. Looking at Elliot, watching his hand, watching his lips wrap around the glass as he pretended to sip, holding his breath. "Thanks," Elliot said, and then Davis led him through the house into the patio door while Jennifer ducked into the kitchen. It was cold outside, damn cold, Elliot thought, even with his jacket on. Davis, however, was reclined in the chair opposite him, in nothing but a polo shirt, his breath puffing out in waves of white and gray, and he seemed to be fine. He was smiling. The glass in Elliot's hand was cold, too, sticking to his fingers. The yard was filled with charcoal smoke from the hissing grill next to the patio table. It smelled of meat and seasoning, smoke and fire and nourishment. It reminded Elliot of old times, though he supposed the smell of charcoal and beef reminded everyone of old times. Fireworks and cookouts and that pungent aroma of barbecue sauces and burning molten fat. Elliot looked up, and through the white and gray smoke he could just make out a handful of stars in the otherwise black sky. Out there was no light pollution. Out there was just wood smoke and grilling steak, that pungent aroma of barbecue sauces and burning fat. Davis sighed, and Elliot looked over at him again. Davis was still smiling. Elliot wondered what he was thinking, what normal people thought when they were in their backyard grilling steak and looking up at the stars. "Getting cold, Elliot," Davis said, still gazing skyward. "Yeah," Elliot replied. "Another couple weeks and it'll be too cold for this." "I know," Elliot said. "We have to make the best while we can." And with that, Davis upended his glass. Elliot heard the tick of ice cubes on Jeff Davis's teeth as the last of the bourbon slid down. Davis set his glass down, then reached next to him, and with the pop of a plastic seal, Davis produced two Lone Stars. He cracked them both and handed one across to Elliot. Davis chugged from his own. Elliot looked down at the drinks in his hands, both icy cold, both chilling his fingers. Davis chugged again, and Elliot set down the glass and raised the beer to his lips. It bit into his tongue, bitter cold and delicious. Elliot chugged, then shook his head and lowered the beer. Davis laughed. Been a while, Elliot? It has. Tell me, they let you drink in there? Elliot didn't get it at first. Then, oh. He took another swig of beer, ice water running down his knuckles and the bubbles that had been locked in the can running down his throat. He lowered the can again and said, not really. Not really. Davis chugged from his own can, emptying it. He opened another. Sometimes when a big game was on or at holidays, Welton would ration out a few sips for those of us he thought could drink it. Welton? Dr. Welton. Elliot couldn't think of a word. He shrugged. His head felt a bit lighter already. Oh, Davis said. He's a good doctor and a good man. I think, Davis said, beer in hand, a man feels more like a man with a bottle of suds in his paw. You agree? Elliot nodded, setting his own beer down. Davis set his down, too, then stood and opened the grill's lid. A billow of smoke flew up, and Elliot watched it disperse into the cold air. He closed his eyes and breathed deeply of the smoke. Elliot heard a metallic flick and opened his eyes to see Davis lighting a cigarette as he inspected the steaks. There were three of them, Elliot saw, beautiful ribeyes that would make any Texan proud. For just a moment, Elliot felt that pride himself. Then Davis grabbed one with a pair of tongs and flipped it, sending a torrent of juice and fat down into the coals. They hissed and spat, and more smoke drifted up into the black. Behind Elliot, the screen door slid open, and he turned to see Jennifer step out with a stack of plates. She pushed the door shut behind her and smiled at Elliot. Her eyes glinted in the weak light from the incandescent above Elliot's head. Jennifer was wearing a thick sweater. She set down the plates in front of Elliot. I thought we could eat out here. Might be the last time this year. Good idea, Davis said, pulling on his cigarette and replacing the grill's cover. Jennifer placed a hand on Elliot's shoulder and said, are those almost ready? Just about, Davis answered. Jennifer removed her hand and turned to go back inside. Elliot felt the lingering warmth long after the screen door had slid shut again, and Davis was back in his chair, sipping his beer and looking up into the night. The steaks were cooked to a turn, and the three-bean casserole Jennifer made as a side put Elliot's usual takeout dinners to shame. The three of them sat under the lone bare bulb of the patio light and ate, drank, and talked. They talked of sports. Mostly Davis talked of sports. They talked of work. Mostly Jennifer talked of work. Elliot told a few stories of life in the hospital, nothing too revealing, just the cute stories Elliot knew would make them smile or laugh, or think just enough to fill the space between bites of red meat and sips of cheap wine. Jennifer kept the wine flowing until the bottle was empty and Davis began cracking Lone Stars again. The two of them drank most of it, but Elliot found himself growing increasingly drunk with each sip. Years of isolation and prescription medicine, it seems, were not sufficient to build an alcohol tolerance. After two glasses of wine and the last of his first beer, Elliot decided to really switch to water. He stood, assuring Jennifer he could find the sink, and carried his untouched scotch into the kitchen. Elliot poured the drink down the sink, then closed his eyes, leaning his weight on the edge of the counter. He wasn't cold anymore, that was for sure, but he found himself looking at Jennifer more and more, staring almost. He examined the pigment in her skin, rosy in the chilly light. He observed the way her nostrils pulsed when she spoke, and especially when she laughed. He saw how her breath came out in big satin clouds, but slowly and delicately. More than once, he thought perhaps she was doing the same thing. And that was when he decided to come inside and get himself a glass of water. He didn't hear the patio door open. He didn't hear the wisp and pat of socks on carpet. He didn't hear her breath as she stood behind him. He held his eyes shut until he felt her hands on his, her fingers sliding between his and curling under. He felt her body press against his, and his in turn against the counter. He felt her breath on his neck as she moved her mouth to his ear. But still, he heard nothing. He heard nothing until... Elliot. A whisper as soft as silk and hot against his cold skin. Elliot spun to face her. She stepped back, but smiled. What? He said, more than asked. Jennifer pressed a finger to her lips. Shh. We can't. Elliot. Shh. Elliot closed his mouth and Jennifer stepped toward him. She pulled him close to her and wrapped her arms around, pressing her chin between his neck and shoulder. I just want to feel you, Elliot, that's all. She squeezed, pulling him tighter, and Elliot felt his own arms around her, his hands in the small of her back. And that is how they stood, holding each other in the kitchen, until the patio door opened again and Jennifer pulled away, still smiling to fill Elliot's glass in the sink. He heard the words in his head, Davis's voice. Been a while, Elliot? A dream that night of blue and gray. Elliot finds himself in the dark, a great weight pressing against him. Above him, muted explosions, shouting, screaming. Elliot pushes against something that is both hard and soft, warm and cold. It doesn't give. Elliot shifts his weight and something falls away on one side of him. He shifts again and sees a sliver of cold blue light. He grunts and pushes his hand toward it, fighting to free his elbow from underneath his body. A long struggle, a long agonizing moment when he thinks it won't give. Then something snaps beside him and his arm is up and out. He feels a breeze on it as his hand grasps the air. Elliot grunts again, worming himself toward the light. His hand falls on cloth, clutches at buttons and belts. It's no use. He's not moving. Elliot begins to panic, feeling the weight around him, the weight on him. He pushes with his shoulders. He tries to move his hips. The weight grows. His hand opens and closes in the cool air above, and Elliot begins to scream. It's loud, but only in his head. In the tight space, the space just barely the size of his body, it's thick and wet, weak and muffled. Elliot screams and screams, squeezing his eyes shut, his one arm jutting upward into freedom, the other trapped beneath something to his side. He screams and tears fall down his cheeks. He screams and then realizes he can't breathe. His heart is throbbing, his lungs burn. He pushes air out of them through his vocal cords, but all that comes out is a raspy whisper. It is wordless. It is shapeless. He struggles. His hand opening, closing, opening, closing, opening, closing on nothing, nothing. And then the weight is lifting and Elliot is sliding through the soft, wet mass around him and up through to the shaft of light. Elliot is being birthed, and through his teary vision he sees the light growing. He feels the cool air rush into his lungs and they no longer burn. Elliot slides through the slim opening his hand found and stops, the top half of his body exposed. He wipes his eyes and looks down, feeling wetness on his forearm. It's blood, more blood on his face, blood all around. Elliot rubs his eyes again. Below him, where his hips and legs disappear, is a mass of torn gray cloth, buttons, belts strewn. His lungs are burning again. His eyes, too, but it's not suffocation, it's smoke. Smoke everywhere. Elliot barely makes out a tree line in front of him. The mass around him shifts, and he sees more blood and flesh. Flesh, flesh and blood amidst the torn gray and an explosion of sounds above him. He hears more screaming, more explosions, a cacophony of gunfire, and pulls himself up and out over the mass, and he climbs. He clambers up the pile to the top, and he stands on shaky legs. All around is smoke, all around is flesh and blood, a great heaving pile of bodies. The gray of their uniforms is smeared everywhere with their own blood. Beneath him, Elliot sees another belt, this one with two letters burned into it. C.S. Confederate States. And Elliot knows he is in a bad place. He is in the worst place, and he wants to run, but his legs won't move. They're tingling now, and he knows they're dead. They're useless, shot and useless, and the blood on his hands is his own. He looks down at the tattered remains of his own legs, sees the flesh hanging in strips from gleaming white bones, sees tendons taut against his knees, and Elliot screams again, but now he's gagging from the smoke, and he falls, and there's blood, blood everywhere, and yes, yes, it is his own blood from his own dead legs, and all around him are bodies. Elliot turns onto his stomach, begins to pull himself with his bloody hands, but they're too slick. He grasps the leather belts of the dead soldiers and pulls himself up. He doesn't know where he's going, what he's heading for, but he's pulling and pulling, and his hands are too slick from all this blood all around. And Elliot tries to scream and feels the gun smoke burning his throat, his eyes, his lungs, and he's looking into something now. Into eyes, a pair of eyes, dead eyes, and they are looking back. And Elliot thinks he can hear the boy, yes, just a boy, a dead boy. Elliot can hear the boy screaming, but the boy doesn't move. The boy's hand is closed around a drumstick, a shattered thing of cheap wood and cheap labor, slave labor, and Elliot's hands are so slick, so wet, and growing sticky now, and he feels his legs burning, but he knows that they are not really, because they're not there. They're not there, and then an explosion close by, and Elliot holds his arms over his head as everything becomes ringing and screaming and ringing and ringing, the ringing in his ears. He hears nothing now but the thud of his own heart, the heart futilely pumping blood through veins that lead to nothing but air, pumping his own hot blood out of what were once his legs and into the pile, more blood into the pile. His blood is spewing out, coursing through the bodies, soaking the earth. His blood is running into the dead boy's eyes, the dead boy's dead eyes, and over the dead boy's dead fingers, following the wood of the drumstick, going down, down, down into the earth, soaking into the rich earth, and Elliot still hears nothing. But that's not true. He hears a ringing, and he hears the scratching of tiny legs on cloth and dead skin. He hears something climbing the pile of rotting, smoky meat toward him. Something big. Something. He sees it. It comes to him. It stops in front of him, and it looks at him. It is wearing a gray uniform stained with blood. Its black eyes look at him. Its legs poke out of a half a dozen holes in its uniform. It looks at him, and it says nothing, the bug, the cicada. Elliot stares back into its black eyes. The bug moves. Joseph steps closer to Elliot's face, and his black eyes are just inches away. One of Joseph's legs reaches up and adjusts his little gray cap, straightening it on his tiny little bug head. Joseph opens his mouth, and he speaks, and Elliot hears the words when all the world is just a ringing in his ears. Joseph says, "It will not stand, Professor." And there you go, Rachel.
Wonderful. That was something else, Jacob. I appreciate you coming on and being able to share that with us. What's your next step with this novel?
Well, like I said, I'm finishing up the what is presumably the final draft right now. And then with the help of a couple people I know that are kind of very enthusiastic about helping me get it into the world, going out to agents and finding it a home at some publishing house.
Wonderful. So you have some friends, you have a network to help you out.
I do have a network to help me out.
Mm-hmm.
And the network is key. The people are key.
It is. And I was just talking with other writers about this recently, that it's who you know. And so if you can get connected with other people, that's really the way to go.
Yeah. I think a part of it is the connection thing, but another part of it is really just having, this is going to sound cheesy, but having a network of support,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Absolutely.
Just having enough people standing behind you and pushing you with all their might. Maybe against your will, but pushing you forward. That's what we all need.
Right. They know what's good for you.
Exactly.
Well, I sure appreciate you coming on the air today, and thank you for joining me by phone. And we'll wrap it up. So best of luck to you, Jacob.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And we'll be in touch again when the book is out on bookshelf for people to buy, and they can say they heard it here first.
Sounds like a plan.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much, and thanks to all of you for listening. This is The Weekly Reader, and I hope you'll tune in next week.